Well, one of the hallmark doctrines of the Church of God is the keeping of the seventh day Sabbath. And this one doctrine alone separates the Church of God from numerous mainstream Christians who believe that Sunday should be the day of worship. Those in mainstream Christianity would view the seventh day keeping as kind of strange and offbeat, and sounds like kind of Jewish, you know, keeping that Jewish Sabbath day. As they feel, it was an Old Testament observance, and the day of worship was changed to Sunday when we get to the New Testament and the time of Jesus and the apostles. When people find out that you keep the Sabbath day, there's usually perplexion, like, really? Boy, that's interesting. it just comes at them. And you're a Christian? Yeah. And you keep the seventh day. Okay. And there's, you know, confusion in their parts, because that doesn't make sense. But I submit to you that the observance of the seventh day Sabbath is one of the most provable doctrines that the Church of God has. It's incredibly provable. It's so plain. It's mentioned throughout the Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament. It is a no-brainer for those who solely look to Scripture and not to any ideas of man. So in this two-part sermon, I'd like to review and refute the arguments that would support Sunday keeping as opposed to keeping the seventh day as the day of worship. We're also going to see, well, what happened? What happened? It's throughout the Old Testament, and it's even in the New Testament, the Sabbath, but it's Sunday now. How did that happen? We're going to go through the historical reasons why that transition occurred. And we're going to see that any arguments for Sunday keeping are frivolous, they're baseless, and some of the arguments are just plain idiotic, to be blunt. But the arguments or the truth of keeping the Sabbath day, the seventh day, are, again, they are crystal clear. They're provable, and they're completely biblical. So let's go to Genesis 2. The book of Genesis is the foundation. It's a foundational chapter for many, many things. Genesis chapter 2, as a review for us. Verse 1, thus the heavens and the earth were completed, all their hosts. And by the seventh day, God completed his work, which he had done. And he rested on the seventh day from all his work, which he had done. Okay, maybe we can stop there and say, well, that's just a matter of fact. You know, 6 days, 7 days of rest. But we notice verse 3. Then God, he blessed the seventh day. And he sanctified it. He set it apart in a very special way. Because in it, he rested from all his work, which God had created and made. So just in chapter 2 of the beginning of the Bible, right, we have this establishment of the seventh day as a very special day, a sanctified day by God himself. Then we jump to the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20. Let's go there. Exodus chapter 20. And in verse 8, the fourth commandment, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Yeah, remember it because it was ordained at creation. It's not something brand new for the Israelites, but it's remember it, and as well as to keep it holy, part of the fourth commandment. And we'll just stop right there. Now, many will argue that, well, sure, it's in the Old Testament and can't argue that it's part of the Old Covenant. I can't argue against that. But it changed. It changed with the arrival of Jesus, would be the argument. It changed with the New Covenant. It changed when the Lord's Day kicked in, and that was Sunday. And there's examples, they would say, in the New Testament that shows, yeah, that the church started to gather on Sundays to keep the quote-unquote the Lord's Day. That's the argument. But did Jesus anticipate that a new day of worship would be established for God? What do we find? Let's go to the New Testament, Matthew chapter 12. Matthew 12 and verse 8. We just have one verse here. A statement by Jesus in Matthew 12 and verse 8. It says the following: For the Son of Man, Jesus, is Lord of Sunday. He's Lord of Sunday. Well, hopefully you'll throw a pie in my face if I really believe that. Got up here. But he's Lord of the Sabbath. And everyone knew what the Sabbath was. It's a given. It's the seventh day. Jesus himself made that statement. It was a great time for him to say, yeah, but it's, hold on, because it's going to change soon. So probably wouldn't even make this statement. Why confuse people, right? But he made that plain statement. Luke chapter 6 and verse 5. Luke chapter 6 and verse 5. Same thing here. Basically, he was saying to them, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Not only recognizing the Sabbath, but saying, wow, the Son of Man, the Messiah, who he was and started to proclaim, is, you know, the Lord of the Sabbath. Is here to talk to you about it, to keep it, and to talk to you about it, as we will see. If you think about the four gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, right? They wrote, you know, after Jesus had died, right? And that was a good opportunity to start in their writings in the gospels to kind of minimize anything that would happen on the Sabbath, right? But what do you find? There's all kinds of stories. Jesus went to the temple on the Sabbath. He healed on the Sabbath. All kinds of information regarding the seventh day Sabbath day. And let's take a look at some of those activities involving Jesus and the Sabbath. To go back a couple chapters here, Luke chapter 4. Luke chapter 4. And in verse 31, Luke 4:31, he came down to Capernaum, a city of Galilee, and he was teaching them on Sabbath days. That's when he would teach. He was setting the example. Like, that's a time to gather. That's a commanded assembly. And certainly, he had the ability and desire to teach at that time, specifically on the Sabbath. And they were just amazed at his teaching. And verse 31. There was a man in the synagogue, verse 33. He was possessed by the spirit of unclean demon. He was demon-possessed. And he cried out. And Jesus rebuked him in verse 35. Be quiet and come out of him. And the demon came out. This was done specifically on the Sabbath day. And even in verse 38, Simon's mother-in-law, Peter's mother-in-law. Peter was married then, wasn't he? The supposed pope was married. Gotta think about that one, right? But she was suffering from a high fever. They made requests of him on her behalf, and he rebuked the fever, all on the Sabbath day. And in both cases, Jesus performed a wonderful humanitarian act of really alleviating people from sickness. Let's go to Mark chapter 3, because there were religious leaders that did not like what was happening. Certainly on the Sabbath day, what Jesus was doing. Mark chapter 3 and verse 1 says, he entered into the synagogue. A man was there with a withered hand, and they were watching him to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath in order that they might accuse him. In their minds, that would be an act of work. And if he really went forward to doing that, haha, we got him. This man's breaking the law. He's breaking the laws of God. That's why they were there. Verse 3, he said to the man with the withered hand, "Rise and come forward." And he said to them, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save a life or to kill?" But they kept silent. And after looking around them with anger, grieved at the hardness of heart, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." Then he stretched it out, and his hand was restored. Now, how did the Pharisees react to this wonderful miracle of Jesus? They went out and immediately began taking counsel with the Herodians against him and how they might destroy him. So they had in their minds, that was part of the rules of the Sabbath. You can't do that. You can't do that. And it was they were so hateful that he operated that way, that we're going to have to kill this guy. He's messing us up. He's messing up all the things that we're telling the people to do. We're going to destroy this guy. We're going to destroy him. Now, was Jesus breaking the Sabbath? Was he breaking the commandment to rest on the Sabbath? Well, absolutely not. What we could say what he was doing was he was instituting reforms. He was instituting reforms on Sabbath keeping, because he had to counteract the legalism of the Pharisees. Because in years just prior to Jesus, the religious leaders of that day, the scribes and Pharisees, they had added all these do's and don'ts, mostly don't do this on the Sabbath day. Now, according to this Rabbi Jonan, there were 1,521 added laws, 1,521 added laws. And supposedly that was to help people in keeping it holy, but it just turned the Sabbath day into a legalistic ritual where people were like, "Oh, the Sabbath is coming. Oh, you know, too bad, you know, because we can't do this, this, and that, and I have to do this, and I have to prepare to a ridiculous degree, and make sure I don't, you know, walk more than 5 feet," and, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff that they came up with. And so it became a burden. The Sabbath was the burden of keeping it instead of the day that they would look forward to and rejoice in and be happy at, and rejoice certainly at a miracle that would be performed on that day. And again, we noticed that Jesus grieved at their cold-hearted attitude, which is the total opposite of what the Spirit should be, certainly on the Sabbath day, any day, but certainly on the Sabbath day. And when we have the opportunity, you know, a lot of times during the week we're busy, perhaps we're working, whatever, going to school. But, you know, Sabbath day is a great day to visit someone in the hospital, right, or a shut-in, and spend some time with them. You know, that's a positive thing. That's certainly in the spirit of what Jesus did to help others out and encourage them. Just an aside as far as, you know, how to practice it for us. Let's go to Matthew 5, because let's just understand what was the overall attitude of Jesus to the laws that were stated in the Old Testament. Well, in Matthew 5, we have the statement in verse 17. Matthew 5:17 by Jesus, who said, "Don't think, do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill," or fill to the full. "For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law till all is accomplished. And whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." And that would certainly include the fourth commandment, to remember the Sabbath day, to keep it holy. Jesus came to magnify law, to even go into the details and the intent of the laws, such like he did with murder. He says, okay, you don't just murder someone is bad, but if you harbor the spirit of hatred towards them, that is breaking the commandment. He made it even more detailed. He put a magnifying glass doesn't destroy it. I see more than I ever saw before. That's what Jesus came to do with the law. And it was necessary for him to correct errors that had crept in by the religious leaders through the decades before he showed up. Let's go to Mark chapter 7. We have the principle here with the Pharisees and the scribes gathering together. They asked Jesus in Mark 7, verse 5, "Hey, how come your disciples don't walk according to the traditions of the elders, but they eat their bread with impure hands? Hey, they don't go through these ritualistic cleansings, to purify themselves spiritually before they eat something." It's not talking about washing your hands, as far as hygiene. But how come you're not following these rules that were laid down, that the fathers laid down? And Jesus said to him, well, verse 8, "Rightly did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites," Jesus was blunt, "that this people, they honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. But in vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the precepts of men." The precepts of men. That was the problem. They had come up with these rules and regulations, and those became the all-important things. And they couldn't even see things like healing, a blind person, casting out a demon would be the most wonderful thing on the Sabbath. That would be awesome to have happen. Okay, Luke chapter 13. Luke chapter 13. And starting in verse 10, he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. There was a woman, 18 years, had a sickness caused by a spirit. She bent double. She could not straighten up at all. Just a terrible sight. 18 years. When Jesus saw her, he called over her and said, "Woman, you are freed from your sickness." And he laid hands upon her. Immediately, she was made erect again and began glorifying God. And the synagogue official, indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, began saying to the multitude in response, "Hey, you realize there's 6 days in which work should be done? Therefore, come during them and get healed, but not on the Sabbath day." Hey, Jesus has known scriptures. You're not supposed to heal on the seventh day. Do it on the other days, but not on the Sabbath day. Verse 15, "But the Lord answered him and said, you hypocrites, does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the stall and lead him away to water him?" Isn't that work to get up and do that on the Sabbath day? "And this woman, a daughter of Abraham, as she is, whom Satan has bound for 18 long years, should she not have been released from this bond on the Sabbath day?" And he said this, all his opponents were being humiliated, and the entire multitude was rejoicing over all the glorious things being done by him. So Jesus was, in a very dramatic way, showing that the Sabbath is, this is not working, you know, to heal someone. And the rules that men have come up with to say that that would be working are ridiculous, and they're just plain wrong. And he showed them very, very plainly. Well, let's notice, Jesus is not advising to break the great commandment. He's not changing the day. He's not saying, I'm going to do more miracles tomorrow because that's Sunday and that's going to be even a better day, you know, to heal. He didn't do that at all. But he's like, we have to really get back to the point of the Sabbath, what is good and what is not good. And what does the Sabbath point to? You know, this is something we should always think about every week. The Sabbath points to the millennial rest. You know, we have a weekly rest, but we have a millennial rest coming up when Christ returns. And that's going to be a time of healing, right? That's going to be a time of peace and healing and abundance. Well, let's go to John chapter 5. John chapter 5. We have a statement here in verse 16. The Jews, John chapter 5, verse 16, the Jews were persecuting Jesus because he was doing these things on the Sabbath, like healing. But he answered and said, my Father is working now, and I myself am working. Now, he meant I'm working just like the Father would work, right, who had love for humanity, who is there to give, you know, compassion and help. And I'm following, certainly, you know, to represent God on earth. And yeah, that's, if you want to call that working, that's working. But these are, you know, works of righteousness, not works that would be breaking the Sabbath commandment. In verse 18, for this cause, though, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because he not only was breaking the Sabbath in their minds, but also he was calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. Jesus said in verse 19, and he said, truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself unless it is something he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, these things the Son does also in like matter. He was always very careful to say, I'm not rebelling against the commandments given. I'm not doing that at all. I'm here to really speak the words of the Father, to magnify those laws and show you the way. He never set out with his own agenda in trying to change things. Always to back up God's truth. Always. There's a note here from a writer, M.J. LaGrange. He says the following quote, that Jesus was careful to distinguish between that which was contrary and that which was in harmony with the spirit of the law. Jesus was working like the Father, and if the actions of the Father in no way contradicted the rest prescribed by the scriptures, then the activities accomplished on the Sabbath by the Son were not contrary to the spirit of that institution. Sure, Jesus never sinned. He never broke the law. And he always upheld it. Always, of course. Well, let's go to Mark 2, because we're going to go to a passage that is infamous for people to argue that, hold on, you know, let's go to Mark 2, because Jesus, clearly, he broke the Sabbath. You know, he wasn't a legalistic. He wasn't... He was more apt to say, hey, let's not get crazy. You know, it's okay to work. You know, why? And that's our example, right? So let's go to Mark chapter 2. Verse 23. Came about that Jesus, was passing through the grain fields on the Sabbath. And his disciples began to make their way along while picking the heads of grain. The Pharisees saw what was happening, and they flipped out. They said, oh, here we go. See here what they are doing? This is not lawful on the Sabbath. Look what they're doing, disciples of Jesus. How do you allow this to happen? And he said to them, have you never read what David did when he was in need and became hungry, he and his companions? How he entered into the house of God in the time of Abiathar the high priest, he ate the consecrated bread, which is not lawful for anyone to eat except the priests. And he gave it also to those who were with him. And he was saying to them, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. The Sabbath is for something positive to occur for the people that observe it. It's not a law unto itself. Let us conform to these rules and regulations of the Sabbath. No, the Sabbath is designed to assist and help. And then he added, consequently, the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Hey, I'm here. I'm the Messiah. I'm here to explain really the intent of keeping the Sabbath and the wrong ideas that have been generated on what you can or you cannot do. Now, let's just go to Matthew 12. We have a little bit more information here. It actually just confirms what we just read. Matthew 12 and verse 1. At that time, Jesus went on the Sabbath to the grain fields, and his disciples became hungry. They began to pick the heads of grain and eat. I mean, this was not, something flippant. I mean, they needed to eat. You know, the human need to get sustenance. And, to keep operating. So that's all they were doing. They were just there to satisfy a very basic need. And so that's what they did. But, in the opinion of the rabbis, here's why the actions were wrong, what they did. Because they plucked the ears of grain, right? They did. Well, guess what? You're guilty of reaping. You can't reap on the Sabbath day. That's against the statutes. They said, they rubbed it in their hands, right? That's a agricultural job of threshing. You separate the grain from the husk, get the things that you actually can eat. Oh, now you're winnowing. Wow, three things. This work that's being done. And guess what? The whole procedure, what they're doing, you're preparing a meal on the Sabbath day? Wow, you are guilty. You are so guilty of all these things. And they thought it was an outright desecration of the Sabbath. But that is just ridiculous. All they were doing is, let's just get something to tie us over, to satisfy a need. That's not going out into the field and getting, the horse or the donkey and, spending 5 hours, in the fields and, spending hours, picking out. That would be work. That's to be done on the other 6 days when you are farming. But they went overboard to a ridiculous degree. All the disciples were doing was trying to get something to eat. They're hungry. And, this really comes back to, we have time here. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 21. Let's go through the account of David. 1 Samuel 21. Verse 1. David came to Nob to Ahimelech, the priest, and Ahimelech came trembling to meet David and said to him, why are you alone? No one's with you. And he said to him, the king has commissioned me with a matter And he said to me, let no one know anything about the matter while I'm sending you. Now therefore, verse 3, hey, what do you have in your hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found. And the priest answered David and said, well, there's no ordinary bread on hand, but there's this consecrated bread. If only the young men have kept themselves from women. And David answered, and the priest said, well, surely women have been kept from us, as previously when I set out, and the vessels of the young men were holy, though it was an ordinary journey, and how much more today will their vessels be holy? So in verse 6, the priest gave him consecrated bread, because there was no bread there, but for the bread of the presence, which was removed from before the Lord, in order to put hot bread in its place when it had been taken away. So it was consecrated bread. I mean, that was the point of having it there with respect to the temple ritual worship. But think about it. David didn't just go grab it and, we need some bread for the journey. Now, there was a situation where, they're running for their lives. I mean, they needed to eat. This was a true emergency. You read between the lines. David asked permission. He said, can we have this? He was incredibly respectful under the situation. The priest understood the situation, that it was legitimate to provide for their special needs during the Sabbath and during, not just the Sabbath, but in terms of technically, yes, legalistically, only the priest should partake of that bread. But this was an emergency. This was asked with permission, and the priest granted that permission. So, as Jesus said, that was fine. He relayed the story. He's like, well, that was fine. In the same way, this was a legitimate need here with my disciples to just, go through, pick some grain out, munch on some things. Like, that's not breaking the Sabbath. That's not the point of resting on the Sabbath. And he was bringing that out. But as we had already gone through, in the eyes of the scribes and Pharisees, any humanitarian deeds were just forgotten. And in fact, they were not just forgotten that was good, but they would denounce Jesus, who's doing these wonderful miracles on it. Let's go to Matthew, back to Matthew chapter 12. Let's just finish up the story in a sense here. Matthew 12. In verse 5. Have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple, they break the Sabbath and are innocent? This is a follow-up to what Jesus said. If you think about it, the priests are doing work on the Sabbath day. They got to light the lamps. They got to do certain things. That's work. I mean, they're physically working. But is that breaking the Sabbath? Well, of course not, because that's part of the commandment for them to do that. So he was pointing that out, that no, that's something good. That's something positive. So there's no problem with that. And then he said, but I say to you in verse 6, that something greater than a temple is here. But if you had known what this means, verse 7, I desire compassion and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. So Jesus is saying, listen, you're missing the point. The Sabbath is made for man. And God is a God of compassion. And he just doesn't want the rituals, and you must do it this way, and there's nothing else you can do. It's an emergency, too bad. But even in the statutes, if the ox fell in the ditch, it would be like, you can take that ox out, help it out. An animal's going to die if it doesn't get freed. You know, even in the statutes, there's points there that show, hey, that's something good. Like, don't worry about that. That's something that can be taken care of. Again, Jesus was pointing out the things that messed up in the minds of the religious leaders. And of course, they were influencing the people. That's the way you should act too. Let's go to the book of Hebrews. We have a fascinating chapter here in Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews chapter 4. Let's start in verse 1. It says, therefore, let us fear, lest while the promise remains of entering his rest, any of you should seem to have come short of it. What kind of rest is he talking about? For indeed, we have heard good news preached to us, just as they also, but the word they heard did not profit them, because it was not united by faith in those who heard. He's kind of alluding to the Israelites under the old covenant. Verse 3, for we who have believed enter that rest, just as he has said, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest, although his works were finished from the foundation of the world. For he has thus said somewhere concerning this seventh day, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again, the passage, they shall not enter my rest. Therefore, it seems it remains for some to enter it, and those who are formerly had good news preached to them failed to enter because of disobedience. It's definitely alluding here to the Israelites. And there were really two huge sins that they committed. You know, we'll have time to go through the history of Israel. But idolatry was giant. You know, when they started to worship the pagan gods and set up idols, right? You see that time and time again. But you also see the breaking of the Sabbath. That was one of the biggest problems that they had. And we have the information in here that, you know, if you want to operate that way, you're not going to have the rest. Now, for the Israelites, What was the end game for them? It was to get to the promised land, right? That was the promise under the old covenant, that they would get to the land of Canaan, that they would have a rest from enemies and prosperity. And of course, if they stopped obeying God, if they had idolatry, if they broke the Sabbath, well, that rest is going to get messed up. It's not going to happen. All the things are going to go wrong if they do not obedient to the commandments, such as the Sabbath rest. And as it says, they failed because of disobedience in verse 6. Let's read on here. He again fixes a certain day, today, saying through David after so long a time, as it has been said before, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts, right? Don't be like the Israelites. We have those as the bad example of disobedience. Don't be like that is being stated here. For if Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken of another day after that. We'll talk about that in a second. Verse 9, there remains therefore a Sabbath rest for the people of God. That's a tough one to explain. If you're mainstream, Sabbath rest, there remains a Sabbath rest, the keeping of the Sabbath in the Greek, for the people of God. And he's talking about, they didn't do it, but let's do it today. Verse 10, for the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works, as God did from his. Yeah, you're following the example of God at creation. Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall through following the same example of disobedience. Now, it's interesting that it talks about verse 8, that Joshua had given them rest, you know, that, and that's a rest of the promised land, right? He would not have spoken of another day after that. It's alluding to the fact that that wasn't the be-all and end-all, you know, the promised land with Israel. That was not the end game for what God's plan of salvation is. His plan of salvation is an ultimate rest, say, starting at the millennial rest when Christ returns, and then, you know, ultimately new heavens and new earth, the eternal state that's coming, that, you know, will be. I mean, that is the plan of God for that time to happen. So if we put everything together here in the first 11 verses, we could say there's like a three-dimensional meaning of the Sabbath. A three-dimensional meaning of the Sabbath. First of all, the Sabbath commemorates the completion of creation that's brought out. And we went to that right in the beginning of the sermon, right? With the seventh-day rest at creation. Later, it came to symbolize the promise of entry into the land of rest, that promised land, Canaan. But it was temporary, right? That wasn't the be-all and end-all. That wasn't it. It's over. That's all God's going to do for humanity. Now, these two meanings point to another seventh-day rest, so to speak, which is yet to come. In the millennium, and, of course, that thousand-year rest for humanity, and then ultimately, you know, the kingdom of God. And it's fascinating that the writer of Hebrews, which I personally believe is Paul, I know sometimes it's the right, we hear the writer of whoever the writer of Hebrews was, well, I think it was Paul. You know, it's funny, go through a bunch of books in the New Testament, never says who wrote the book. I think it's like Mark, never says Mark wrote it. Well, we think Mark wrote it. We say Mark wrote it. Well, it's, all right. That's all I'll have to say. That's my belief. In any event, getting off the subject here. Let's just notice in verse 3, we just go backtrack here. It says, for those who have belief, enter that rest. A better translation would be, are entering into that rest in terms of a present sense, in a present sense. So these scriptures in Hebrew, they really cover the past keeping of the Sabbath, at creation and with Israel, the present. This is the present here we're talking about. We're talking about New Covenant. We're talking about the Church of God. It's still there, and it's going to be in the future. You know, that Sabbath will be realized, you know, in the millennial rest and beyond. So, you know, Paul's saying some profound things in here about the Sabbath day. He's just, it's been there. Israel didn't keep it. They had their issues, but you keep it. You observe it, and always note that it's not an end to itself. It's pointing to something even greater that's going to come down the line. Let's do this. We have a little bit of time. I was going to end right there, but just a little bit more here. We're going to go and just start into alleged parts of the New Testament that mainstream teachers will turn to and say, aha, sure it was the Sabbath, sure it was the seventh day, but yeah, the New Testament tells you that it was changed. It was changed. And let's go to one of those, 1 Corinthians chapter 16. 1 Corinthians chapter 16. And I've read enough commentaries by Protestant commentaries. And typically the commentary is in there like, hey, look at this. You know, this shows that the church started to keep Sunday and the first day of the week. And they make these statements. So one of these is 1 Corinthians chapter 16. 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 1. It says, now concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so do you also. On the first day of every week, let each one of you put aside and save, as he may prosper, that no collections be made when I come. And when I arrive, whomever you may approve, I shall send them with letters to carry your gift to Jerusalem. Aha, here we have it. Here we have it. Here is, says it, the first day of the week, that's Sunday. Here's a command by Paul to gather, and you know, on a new day of worship, right? Isn't that what he's talking about? Well, this was in the spring of probably 55 AD. And Paul recommended a plan to the Corinthian members for a fundraising for the poor in the Jerusalem church. And why would there be a special fundraising needed? Well, there was a famine that was occurring at that time, the Judean famine. And Paul is simply saying, not on the Sabbath, the day of rest, but on the first day of the week, let's get a contribution together, get the goods, get the things that can help, and we can distribute them to those that really need it at this time. That's all that it's saying. It's not saying anything more. It's not saying anything less. There's nothing here that would suggest a public assembly to worship God, you know, in terms of a Sunday service. It's simply setting aside funds to be done by the brethren. In verse 2, the instructions are to lay up the collection, whether it was money or goods, in storage at each person's abode. If there was a public service on Sunday, why don't they just bring everything to church, right? Why don't they, hey, bring everything to church because we're going to be meeting here for a service, and boy, that'll save a lot of time. But they were told that, no, keep it at your home. You know, get ready, you'll get picked up. It is reasonable to recommend, you know, the first day of the week, right after the true Sabbath, for this special fundraising contribution. Because Sunday is one of the days you can work, right? 6 days shall you work, but the seventh is a rest. So you have to read so much into this account to come up with the fairy tale that they were having church services on Sunday. It's just not in there. And there's a historical explanation of why this was going on. And you're disingenuous if you really try to say this is changing the Sabbath day, then you're completely twisting scriptures. Well, guess what? There's a couple more which are argued that we're going to blow out of the water, like this one, to show there's nothing in the scriptures to go against the seventh day. We're also going to go into the history of, well, why did that happen? Why did the bulk of people start to keep Sunday? What happened? Well, there's historical information to show why that happened. And we're going to go through that in the second part.